Most of Cincinnati is in a celebratory mood on Christmas 1883, even in the most unlikeliest of places. Santa Claus is visiting the orphan asylum. In police court, Judge Van Martels is handing out plump turkeys to his staff. Even at the county workhouse, chores are suspended for the day, and inmates are being treated to a decadent meal that includes raw oysters while they're entertained by musicians and a comedian. A little respite of joy and happiness is all around town. But there is none to be found in the attic apartment at 36 Elizabeth Street in Cincinnati's West End neighborhood, next to downtown. In this sparsely furnished home, Minnie Kirk, a woman in her mid-20s, paces the floor with her infant son in increasing despair. She'd probably be out on the streets looking for Bill, but she gave birth just 5 weeks ago. She got sick afterwards, extending her recovery. She's physically not up to wandering around cold city streets carrying a baby. And even if she were, she wouldn't necessarily know where to look. Her husband, Bill Kirk, is 46 years old, roughly twice her age. He's also kind of a secretive man. He compartmentalizes a lot of the aspects of his life. So when Minnie finally asks a neighbor girl to go ask Bill's business partner about him, it's the first time that Strauss, his partner, learns that Kirk has been married for the past 2 years. But Strauss doesn't have any information to give. Minnie last saw Bill on the morning of December 24th. He's a horse trader of some mixed success. It's an unstable income. There are good weeks and bad. To cheer her up, he pulled out a wad of cash and handed it to her to count, to reassure her that they're doing just fine. But she's not done counting when he grabs the money back and tells her that he has to get going. But he's going to be back by 3 o'clock with gifts, and this small family is going to enjoy a nice Christmas together. But Bill doesn't return on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, or the day after. In fact, Bill Kirk never comes home. His body is found on December 27, where it was dumped by the Mill Creek just west of town. He has obviously been murdered. The only good news is that this looks like an open and shut case. The evidence piles up so quickly and compellingly against a grizzled 44-year-old Scotsman named John Neal that the newspapers print calls for his lynching. Then, suspicion quickly shifts to two stable hands, and a series of events is set in place that will change the fate of an entire city. I'm Mike Morgan, a writer, attorney, and historian.
I'm Amy Morgan. I'm also an attorney, but I love true crime and politics. And if it's a story where history is involved, well, that's even better.
And this is Truth Deferred, Season 1, The National Guard Massacre. A true story about biased media, corruption, murder, a slaughter of unarmed civilians by National Guard troops, and the cover-up that followed. A cover-up which hid the truth so well that this is the first time it's being told.
William Kirk's body was found by the Mill Creek, which separates the west side of Cincinnati from its farther west neighborhoods. Spring Grove Avenue runs along the creek. He was lying between the road and the creek, but the body was clearly visible from a house on the other side of Spring Grove, which led to speculation that he was dumped there sometime after Christmas Eve. It's a gruesome sight. His body is rigid, his tongue is protruding from his mouth. That might be related to the rope that had been pulled so tightly around his neck that it became embedded in his skin. Two horrific gashes were at the base of his head, and they each looked like they could have been lethal on their own. He also has multiple other wounds. Part of his skull has been bashed in. He has a large bruise on his forehead above the eyes, suggesting a vicious blow. A bloody silk handkerchief is bound tightly around his head, and his clothing is soaked in dried blood. His hands are tied behind him. It was cold on Christmas Eve, but he isn't wearing a hat or a coat, and there's hay trapped between the rope and his neck, suggesting he was killed inside his stable.
And that quickly leads to a suspect. Kirk shared the stable with his partner, Strauss, and a cartman named John Neal. And a cartman basically means he was a delivery driver, a 19th century version of FedEx. When the police interview Strauss, he has several great pieces of information. He was with Kirk on December 24th. They'd gone to an auction, then parted ways around 5 o'clock, Strauss thinks. Kirk was heading back to the stable, then home, further supporting the idea that he was killed there in his stable. When police asked Strauss if there was anyone who might have wanted to kill Kirk, he gave them an obvious motive. Kirk didn't just pull his money out in big wads at home. He did it all the time. If he needed to pay somebody a dollar for something, he'd pull a thick bunch of bills out of his pocket and make a show of doing it. It seems to have been a way of showing people that he was successful, although it's mostly just obnoxious and it was foolish. And it made him a target for anybody willing to kill a man for his money. And that's a wide suspect pool. But Strauss told them something else. John Neal, the cartman who shared the space, was gruff and curmudgeonly, and he usually dressed like his personality, very unpolished. He always wore a torn and dirty suit. But earlier that day, before Kirk's body had been found, Strauss noticed Neal wearing a new suit, and it was such a surprise that he made a comment about it, and it stuck in his mind. Then, when police searched the stable, they found Kirk's hat and coat stuffed down behind a feed box in Neal's part of the stable. The hat was wet, and officers surmised that someone might have been trying to wash blood off of it. Sadly, Kirk's coat pockets still held Christmas gifts for his wife and his baby. Officers arrest Neal, and they get a warrant to search his apartment.
And that's when he really starts looking guilty. Neal lives like he usually dresses, which is like a broke, apathetic slob. Still wearing his new suit, officers find the clothes that Neal typically wears. They're stained with something dark, something that looks like blood. Tucked into a folding slate writing tablet, officers find $27 wrapped in brown paper. In the corner of a cupboard, they find a second, much larger roll of money wrapped in newspaper and tied with twine. This bundle contains $370, which is about $12,000 in today's money. A fortune for a man of such apparent poverty to have squirreled away in a dark corner. Detective Wappenstein is one of Cincinnati's best cops. He questions Neal, and this makes him look even more guilty. He lied about the last time he was in the stable, and when he was confronted with eyewitness proof, he said, quote, "Well, I was there, but it's nobody's business if I was." He denied having any money hidden in his cupboard, and when he was shown the money, he said, quote, "Well, it is all mine. There's $400 in the cupboard, which I have earned," unquote. There was only $370 in the cupboard. And aside from lying about it, it seems odd that Neal, the tight-fisted miser that he was, wouldn't know exactly how much was there. Then it gets even worse. When Millie Kirk is shown the roll of money found in Neal's cupboard, she says that it looks like the money Bill had been carrying on Christmas Eve. That may sound kind of odd today. I mean, money looks like money. But most of it was in $5, $10, and $20 denominations, which were high currency bills in 1883. It's comparable today to having around $12,000 in mostly 50s and 100s. And both Bill's roll and Neal's roll contained one silver certificate, which was the new currency design. Today, it would be like having a brand new design of the $100 bill and then both fat rolls of cash having exactly one of them. So this looks open and shut. The Commercial Gazette describes Neal as a bad-looking customer. He wears gray whiskers and has keen, piercing eyes. The paper explains that his statements are very contradictory and suspicious. Although the question of accomplices, whether they exist and who they might be, remains unanswered, there is universal agreement that Neal is the right man to be behind bars. The Cincinnati Inquirer agrees, praising Wappenstein for placing the probable murders behind bars so quickly. People even start talking about lynching Neal to save the time and cost of a trial.
Neal absolutely looks guilty as hell. Detectives believe that he bludgeoned Kirk to death shortly after he returned to the stable around 5 o'clock on Christmas Eve. He killed him for the cash that he liked to flash, the money that was found in the cupboard, and secluded his body in the hayloft until he had a good opportunity to dump the body by the Mill Creek. Detective Wappenstein thinks that the only open question is whether or not he had an accomplice. In the 1800s, you could arrest and lock people up for less than probable cause. You could hold them in jail if you thought that they might be a material witness, even if you didn't have any reason to suspect them of the crime. So police bring in Joe Palmer, one of Kirk's two stable hands, hoping that he can help tie up loose ends. The day before Kirk's body was found, the other stable hand, named William Berner, had taken the train to Dillsboro, Indiana. He went there to visit relatives. Cincinnati police telegraph Dillsboro and send word to Berner that he needs to come home and help them solve a murder. He complies and he heads back to Cincinnati. Now, unlike the surly John Neal, Joe Palmer is extremely cooperative. He's around 19 years old and he's muscular. He's a very light-complected biracial man with yellowish eyes and prominent cheekbones. He's a relatively handsome guy. And he's also affable, very friendly. He takes being locked up in stride, and he tells the officers that he's happy to oblige, happy to help, but unfortunately, he doesn't know anything about the murder. When William Berner is brought into the station, he also denies any knowledge of the crime. Berner is 17 years old, German-American. He's smooth-faced, has large blue eyes, and he's considered a good-looking young man as well. Both Berner and Palmer look and act like nice guys, respectable young men. But Berner lacks Palmer's cool. When a detective questions him, he's visibly nervous, and large beads of sweat break out on his forehead and start to roll down his face. His face alternates between looking flush or pale, but he's only being held as a possible witness, and he doesn't say anything to change that. The evidence against Neal is purely circumstantial, but it's strong, really compelling. It looks like Palmer and Berner will be released soon, and Neal will probably be tried, convicted, and hanged for murdering Bill Kirk. Then, a man named Charles Heyman walks into the police station and changes everything.
Heyman owns the Star Livery Stable. He rents out horses and wagons, basically kind of like a 19th century rent-a-car business. He's come to tell police that he rented out a horse and wagon with a cover over the bed to Kirk's stable hands. They rented it at around 5:30 on Christmas Eve, telling him that they needed it to make deliveries for Berner's father, who owned a grocery store. They said they were going to St. Bernard, a village just northwest of Cincinnati, in the same direction where the body was found, and he's starting to suspect they might be involved in some way.
So an officer leads Heyman back to the cells, and he positively identifies both Palmer and Berner. Now, Palmer remains chill about it, saying that Heyman is just mistaken. Around 6 p.m., a police detective, the county prosecutor, and Heyman walk Berner over to the Star Livery Stable. As Berner watches, they inspect the bed of the wagon really carefully. They find blood and hair that they cut out as evidence. Berner sticks to a story that he gave Heyman on Christmas Eve. He says that he went to St. Bernard to deliver groceries, but as he says this, his lips twitch, and his lips tremble when he speaks, and his eyes glisten. He's trying really hard to hold back tears, and William Berner is obviously about to crack.
At the station, Palmer hears that Berner is talking. He's led to believe that Berner is about to throw him under the bus, so he gets nervous. And around 7:30 p.m., he says that he wants to, quote-unquote, confess. He tells police Captain Devine that on Christmas Eve, Berner asked him to accompany him on a trip to St. Bernard to deliver some groceries. He agreed, waited as Berner rented the wagon, and then just went along for the ride. At some point during the ride, Palmer says he started to reach back to get a blanket from the bed, and Berner grabbed his arm, stopping him. He seemed secretive about what was back there. On Spring Grove Avenue, Berner told Palmer to stand by a street lamp and wait for him because he needed to go talk to someone. He was then gone for a while, picked Palmer back up, they went to a bar, then returned to the wagon. Now, Palmer says with a further reflection, he admits, quote, "I haven't a doubt but what Kirk's body was in the wagon."
What a tell-all. So, Palmer's confession is to blame 100% of everything on Berner.
Yes. He knows he can't keep denying that he was with Berner when he rented the wagon and when he returned it, but he's only admitting to what he knows he can't deny.
Smart. Berner then also confesses, and his version is clearly closer to the truth. When he's asked how Kirk was killed after he'd been questioned for around 5 hours, he says that Kirk was killed with a hammer. The detective then brings in Police Chief Riley, and they push Berner for more details. After more interrogation, Riley walks Berner out of his cell and into a room full of police and reporters to make a public confession. He says that on the morning of December 24th, John Neal sold Bill Kirk an old horse for $13.50. To pay Neal, Kirk whips the big roll of money that he'd flashed to his wife before leaving home, that bad habit he has of making a show of how much money he's able to carry around. Palmer has seen him do this before, and he's told Berner that they ought to kill Kirk for it. It looked to Palmer like Kirk had at least $600 on him, roughly the equivalent of about $20,000 today. Palmer looks at Berner, he smacks his lips, and he winks at him, but nothing else is said about it. Then, when Kirk returned to the stable at around 5 o'clock, by Berner's recollection, he started hauling buckets of water. He was talking to Berner with full buckets in both hands when Palmer picked up a hammer and struck him hard in the back of the head. Kirk groaned and he tried to call out, but he couldn't. He fell and Palmer hit him a couple more times. Berner says that he was scared and he started to run away, but Palmer stopped him and he said, quote, "Stay here, you son of a bitch, or I'll kill you." Afraid not to cooperate, Berner went through Kirk's pockets with Palmer, finding either $240 or $245, a fraction of what Palmer thought that Kirk was carrying. Palmer peeled off $100 and gave it to Berner to seal his role as an accomplice. Then he gave him another $5 to go rent a horse and wagon from Star Livery. Berner says that Palmer made up the story about getting groceries and that he directed everything that they did. They tied the rope around Kirk's neck to pull him back behind some hay to conceal the body while they got the wagon. They load Kirk's body up on the wagon and drive from the West End to a 13th Street saloon and over the Rhine, just around the corner from the Berner family grocery. They have a drink there, then they start to drive to Spring Grove Avenue. Berner claims that Palmer drugged the body out of the bed of the wagon on his own and tossed it over the hill. He didn't participate. Then they stopped at another saloon. Then when they were back in the West End, they stopped at another saloon near Berner's girlfriend's house. They returned the wagon around 8 o'clock and then went their separate ways. Berner also exonerates Neal. He says that Neal wasn't involved at all and that Palmer shoved Kirk's hat and coat behind Neal's feed box to frame him.
That sounds mostly believable, but Berner's confession basically places all the blame on Palmer. He's confessing to theft and helping to get rid of a body, but definitely not to murder.
No. He says that 100% of the wounds were inflicted by Palmer or falling down, and he denies planning any part of it in advance.
Since they're both blaming each other, Police Chief Riley thinks it's a good idea to bring them both into his office together. He asks Palmer if he has anything to say, and Palmer says no. Then he makes Berner repeat the confession that he'd just given in front of reporters. When he's done, Palmer says, quote, "My statement is that he is a liar," unquote. Then he says that on the day of the murder, Kirk sent he and Berner to buy some horse herring. But when they were on their way, they ran into John Neal. Mike, what is horse herring? Do you know?
I absolutely do not.
Okay.
I actually, in doing this research and writing the book, I went down a rabbit hole and spent almost a half a day trying to figure out what the hell horse herring is. I could never find an answer. I'm assuming that it was just cheap fish that horses liked. They tossed it in with feed, something.
And that sounds plausible.
That's what we're going to go with.
Sounds good. Anyway, back to the story. Berner walked back to the stable with Neal, and Palmer bought the horse herring on his own. When he got back to the stable, Berner was standing in the doorway, blocking him from entering. He tells Palmer that he has to go to St. Bernard to deliver groceries. Then, Palmer's story is the same as the previous version. They got a wagon, hit some bars, Berner made him stand on Spring Grove Avenue for a while, and he didn't know the body was in the back until he pieced it together early that evening.
Officers then get warrants and search both Berner's room and his parents' house above the grocery and Palmer's apartment. They take Berner with them when they search his room. They find what looks like blood on clothing. Berner then sits down on his bed. He takes off a boot and a sock, and he hands over the $70 he's been hiding there in his sock. This is all the money that he has left from Kirk. The search at Palmer's apartment is less fruitful. They don't find any damning evidence or any money there.
There's no way that Berner can deny having some form of involvement at this point, but they still don't really have any evidence against Palmer.
No, but they're about to. Captain Devine goes back into Palmer's cell around midnight, and he starts questioning him again. We'll spare people any attempt to do voices, but let's walk through the fun part of this interrogation. You be Captain Devine, Amy.
Now, Palmer, you say you went with Berner to the livery stable and hired the wagon?
Yes.
And you were with him constantly, except when he left you by the workhouse and drove back for a few minutes to see a man?
Yes.
You didn't leave him from the time he got the wagon until you got out there on the trip to deliver the groceries? And you supposed that was what he went for and he had the groceries in the wagon then?
Yes.
Well, now tell me when he got the groceries.
You got me. I may as well give up now and tell the truth, for I've been lying all the time. He's still cordial, still acting more like a guy that just lost a poker hand than one that just backed himself into a capital murder charge. But he's busted. He then gives a confession that starts to merge with what Berner has admitted. Palmer says that he and Berner had seen Kirk whip out large rolls of money multiple times, and that they'd conspired to kill him for it when they got a good opportunity. When Kirk came back to the stable at around 4 o'clock, not 5 o'clock, as Strauss remembered and Berner said, and which makes more sense with Heyman's timeline, Berner said to Palmer, according to Palmer, in a low voice, quote, "What do you say?" unquote. And Palmer replies, quote, "It's a go." Then Berner, according to Palmer, picked up a hammer and Palmer picked up a club. And each one of them hit Kirk in the head twice. Palmer then put the rope around Kirk's neck and they both pulled hard on the ends to make sure Kirk was dead. Berner pulled the money out of his pocket. They hid the body, went to a brewery stable on 13th Street to divide up the money. Then they went to a bar across the street. Berner walked around the corner to his house to get a pistol to use in case they ran into any problems with anybody while they were disposing of the body. Then they rented the wagon, loaded up the body, and went out Spring Grove. They pulled the body out and thought they'd tossed it into a culvert that ran under the road. The creek was high, the water was rushing, and it was very dark. So they thought they'd succeeded in getting the body into the water coming out of the culvert, which would have carried it immediately into the Mill Creek, then down to the Ohio River, and it probably wouldn't have washed up for days, miles away. So Berner says, quote, "We are the luckiest sons of bitches in the land," unquote, because both of them believe they'd just gotten away with murder. Then they stopped at the bar near Berner's girlfriend's for several reasons. First, they were obviously on a bar hopping mission in addition to murder, and they wanted to have a drink. And Berner wanted to go see his girlfriend. But they also borrowed a mop and a bucket from the bartender so they could clean out the bed of the wagon. They thought that they'd succeeded in getting rid of any evidence, but it was dark and they couldn't see well. After Palmer finishes telling Devine this story, he says, quote, "Since I've told you all this, I feel 100 pounds lighter," unquote. He genuinely seemed to be relieved not to have to keep remembering lies. When a reporter asks him why he confessed, Palmer chuckles, and he admits that Devine had gotten the better of him. He jokes to the reporter, quote, "I had the wagon all right, but somehow it wouldn't hold the groceries," unquote. He told another reporter that he regretted killing Kirk, but most of his regret seemed to focus on the money. He said he thought Kirk was carrying between $600 to $1,000, and that he wouldn't have killed him just to make $100, which doesn't exactly sound like real remorse. He also explained that the police hadn't found any money in his apartment because it was all gone except for $32.10 that was hidden in his mattress. He'd gone out on the town on Christmas, lived it up, and pissed away the rest of his money.
Palmer confessed enough to hang himself, but he still shifted more of the blame onto Berner. In Berner's next interrogation, he added some information but still maintained a few denials. He admitted that Palmer had talked about killing Kirk for his money several times, but Berner didn't really believe him, and he told him that he wasn't going to murder a man to rob him. He continued to say that he was taken by surprise when Palmer picked up a hammer and struck Kirk in the head, and that Palmer alone had killed Kirk. Then, by the following morning, after being interrogated throughout the night, Berner gives Captain Devine what he's been pressing for. He says that he told Palmer that if he decided to kill Kirk, he was, quote, "ready to help him through," unquote. And he says that after Palmer beat Kirk with the hammer and club, he also struck him with a club, and he helped strangle him, although the autopsy would suggest that Kirk was definitely already dead by then.
Captain Devine eventually manages to get both of them to confess to premeditated murder, but their behavior is very different. Berner cries and breaks down a lot, spending a lot of time sobbing in his cell. Reporters who spend time around him can't help having some sympathy for Berner, even if they think he's guilty of murder, because he doesn't seem like a cold-blooded killer. Palmer is a different story. He acts like a standard-issue psychopath. He doesn't appear to have any conscience. He doesn't exhibit emotion. He spends a lot of time laying on his cot, smoking cigars, laughing, and entertaining reporters with details of his life and the murder itself. But the press loses all of the nuanced differences between these two confessions, as well as the differences in their personalities. Together, they're branded the boy murderers, and they're written about collectively as some of the worst monsters alive.
It was a terrible, senseless murder, but some of the rhetoric in the press seems a little bit confusing. The Commercial Gazette called it the boldest butchery in the history of Cincinnati crime. Part of the outrage and fear was from the fact that it happened in the middle of the afternoon and in the middle of a densely populated neighborhood. There had been more brutal murders, but they were usually domestic violence or drunken arguments in dive bars, situations that most people could distance themselves from. But aside from flashing cash around, Kirk didn't do anything to put himself in the role of murder victim. I guess it felt like it could happen to anybody, and that made it scarier, made it feel like a particularly terrible crime.
And it happened on Christmas Eve. I think that from the moment the Commercial Gazette wrote that the crime, quote, "foully desecrated the world's holy day," unquote, it gave it another hook for newspapers. Every paper in town competed to see who could cover more scintillating details than the next, and it got national coverage. Nashville's Daily American, the Louisville Courier-Journal, St. Louis Dispatch, the Baltimore Sun, the Detroit Free Press, and the New York Times were just some of the newspapers that started closely following this case.
Berners and Palmer's confessions had multiple versions and some important contradictions, but the convenient part of that for newspapers was that it let them pick and choose salacious details. People sometimes act like there's something wrong with those of us who are fascinated by true crime and act like it's a new thing, but that's really nonsense. There were probably more true crime junkies in the 1800s than there are today. The difference is, they got those stories from newspapers. We still have crimes that grip national attention today, but we get most of the details from TV shows, documentaries, or podcasts. In the 1800s, it was newspapers dedicating thousands of words of print to describing the crimes, the crime scenes, the victims, and the perpetrators. A crime didn't need to have to be really worthy of national news coverage to get national news coverage. It just needed to be interesting enough to sell papers. Some crimes became infotainment, and this was one of them.
And Berner's choice of defense counsel made the case even better fodder for reporters. When they're first brought into court, the differences in personalities between Berner and Palmer is clear. When the prosecutor asks Palmer how he's doing, he laughs and says, "All right." Berner, by contrast, hangs his head and he stares at the floor and he frequently looks like he's near crying. They're formally arraigned on January 14th, 1884. The reality of how Berner got his attorney is this, and it's different from the accepted version of events. Berner's father approached T.C. Campbell to represent him. Campbell, because he was the best, charged $5,000 to do a murder trial, over $150,000 today. Berner's father was not wealthy, but he owned the building that the family lived in and that housed his grocery. He mortgaged everything he had, which fell short but came close to Campbell's fee.
We introduced you to T.C. Campbell in the last episode. He's the defense attorney that got Crazy Joe Payton acquitted on murder charges that he was clearly guilty of, the one that's hated by the Commercial Gazette and its editor. Charging a retainer of the modern-day equivalent of over $150,000 is insane, and it definitely says something about people's faith in him.
Campbell told Berner's father that he couldn't take the case because he had trials and proceedings scheduled in D.C. and Columbus, and they were going to keep him out of town for an extended period of time. Also, the Berners didn't really have the money. So, at Campbell's urging, they hired C.H. Blackburn, one of Campbell's law partners. They agreed to hire him for $2,000. That's about 60 grand a day, which shows that Blackburn wasn't T.C. Campbell, but he was no slouch either. He was a very well-respected defense attorney. Then, fate intervened and changed the future of Cincinnati. Blackburn was professionally very competent, but he had a lot of personal problems at this time. He had an inordinate affection for sex workers, shall we say, and that put a strain on both his finances and his marriage. And that was before he started having to duck a paternity suit and an allegation that he'd stolen jewelry from one of his mistresses, presumably to cover financial obligations to another mistress. So Blackburn was distracted. Meanwhile, Campbell's business in both D.C. and Columbus got postponed. And so he was in town with some free time when Berner and Palmer were arraigned. He decided to go to the arraignment to support Blackburn. When Judge Matthews asked Berner if he had legal counsel, Berner said that he thought his dad had hired somebody, but he was standing there in the courtroom alone. Blackburn hadn't shown up, hadn't even met Berner yet. So Campbell, who's sitting in the spectator seat, he stands up and he pleads Berner not guilty. And over the next few weeks, Blackburn continues to be unreliable. Campbell says that he's touched by how hard Berner's father has worked to mortgage everything he owns to try to defend and save his son. And he's also troubled by increasing talk of lynch mobs. So he agrees to become lead counsel on this case, taking less than half of his usual fee and taking it in installments.
But this isn't the story that gets told. The Commercial Gazette writes that Mr. Berner, quote, scraped together $4,500, every penny his little property would bear, unquote, to retain T.C. Campbell. And subsequent stories claim that Berner's wealthy father paid T.C. Campbell $5,000. Eventually, there's even a story that Berner's wealthy father hired Campbell because he bragged that for $5,000, he could get even the most guilty, cold-blooded murderer acquitted. These are small inaccuracies, but they seem important. In reality, Berner's father was a middle-class grocer. He wasn't wealthy. He had to make payments on the $2,000 fee, and the only reason Campbell represented Berner was because Blackburn was hiding from a paternity suit or something. But the newspapers, specifically the newspapers that had a personal animosity to Campbell, made it sound like a rich guy paid a crooked lawyer to fix a jury.
And that pattern would continue throughout the trial. Because Campbell had a good relationship with the Cincinnati Inquirer, the Inquirer's coverage of the trial tended to be more detailed and balanced. By contrast, if you got your news from either the Commercial Gazette or the Post, they often left important aspects of the trial out of their coverage. When something made Campbell's defense look more compelling, both papers would sometimes use snark or nasty quips to dismiss valid arguments without explaining them. We haven't gotten to the trial yet, but we're going to get there, and this is going to be relevant.
Murder of a completely innocent man for a relatively small amount of money, committed by trusted employees in the afternoon, in the heart of the city, on Christmas Eve, and Campbell representing one of the accused killers all helped make this case much more important than the sum of its parts. It became a rally cry, a symbol and litmus test for whether Cincinnati's criminal justice system was capable of hanging a guilty murderer or whether it had been corrupted so thoroughly by T.C. Campbell and John McLean that even someone as clearly guilty as Berner would avoid punishment.
In the abbreviated version of this story, in the generally accepted version of events, it's T.C. Campbell and the Berner trial that sparks the courthouse riot and the massacre that it entails. But the story is really much more complicated. One of the aspects of this story that often gets overlooked is how oddly racially integrated the lynch mob was that began the spiral of events out of control. Black citizens were enraged by the William Kirk murder as much as everybody else. And white citizens were horrified by the Avondale murders. But the Avondale murders were what really convinced black Cincinnatians that the justice system was so broken that it was time to take the law into their own hands. In the next episode, we're going to introduce you to another deadly duo and to the horrific murder of an entire family that made Allen Ingalls and Ben Johnson national news and a local rallying cry of their own. That's it for now. Special thanks to Grab Bag Collab Network for their help on this podcast. And please check out grabbagcollab.com for more podcasts that we think you're really going to love. And additional thanks to our producer and director, Dan Fennessy. We will See you guys next episode.
See you next time.